Welcome to a new episode of Land Grant Holy Land Stick to Sports Podcast. My name is Matt Timonini, and on Stick to Sports, we do talk about Ohio State athletics, but more often than not, we avoid the X's and O's of said sports and dive into what is going on around the periphery of the games, as well as whatever else is keeping us occupied and entertained in between. As always, I am joined by Land Grant Holy Land West Coast Bureau Chief Jamie Urich. Jamie, happy halfway through 2022.
Thank you so much. Happy halfway through 2022 to you too, Matt.
It seems like one of those made up things like in Alice in Wonderland, like a very merry on birthday, but...
Oh my gosh. I'm into that this year though. That's the vibe of the year.
Oh really? Why is that?
I don't know. I just feel like the year, like I don't want to celebrate 2022. I want to celebrate like surviving half of it.
That's fair. That is very good point. We're going to kind of talk about that through the lens of pop culture by talking about some of our like favorite pieces of pop culture so far in 2022 at the end of the episode in our recommendation section, which might be fairly long, to be honest with you, because that is generally what we do. But Jamie, we were planning on getting back into a regular potting schedule in July anyway, but with the news last week, it kind of made it a necessity that I talk to you specifically because you grew up in the biggest city in the Big Ten footprint. You went to, objectively, the Big Ten's flagship institution. And now, somewhat surprisingly, you are once again living in the middle of Big Ten country as LGHL's resident Angelino. What was your first response to hearing the news that USC and UCLA will officially be joining the Big Ten come 2024?
Okay, so my first response was not an analytical one or deciding whether this was actually a good thing or not. My first response was, oh, thank God the Buckeyes are going to play out West.
Yeah, absolutely. That's very fair.
Like not just a Rose Bowl, not just a bowl game. I will get to go to games regularly. And I like really, really love both USC and UCLA stadiums. Like they're just fun places.
Yeah, of course.
To game. So I was like, these are going to be fun road games for me to be at as an OSU fan. I was selfishly so excited. And like my roommate had the same response as some of you may know. She went to that school up north.
Yeah,
so, but the same response of like, oh my gosh, I get to like go to games. Like it's, I think for Big Ten fans who live out West and don't have the opportunity to see their teams play regularly, it's selfishly like a fun thing. Now, I will say my friends who went to USC and UCLA who regularly attend games had the exact opposite reaction that I had, and they are very unhappy.
Why is that? Is it because they are losing the traditions of the Pac-12, or they don't like the Big Ten for some specific reason, or are they nervous about playing what is decidedly a better level of competition? What is it about the move that they do not like? Because from an athletic and institutional standpoint, it is going to bring them a lot more money, at least to their schools, which you would imagine would trickle down into the football programs and other sports as well.
Well, and so it's interesting to that point, Matt, because my little brother just graduated from Tennessee, but obviously as an SEC graduate who is really a Buckeye fan at heart, like really pays attention to college football. So he texted me to be like, what do you think? And he was like, you know, UCLA is going to go 4-8 in the Big Ten every season. And I said, yeah, at first, but with that money, with that kind of harder schedule does come better recruiting. And so I do think that they're going to be able to kind of play the long game.
If they want to, I think that's the difference. If that's the difference between UCLA and USC, like Chip Kelly has been at UCLA for I don't know how many years now, and he has got them to a point where I don't know that they can get much further. I think he's hit their ceiling because the administration at UCLA has long been known for not really giving a shit about football or sports in general. So if this additional money that comes from being a part of the Big Ten is in the middle of negotiating its next TV rights deal, and it is expected that they will be the first conference in college football history to secure a rights deal for more than $1 billion per year. If that's the case, they're going to have a lot more money, and how much they actually invest back into the football program is yet to be seen. But in theory, you're absolutely right that they should be able to upgrade facilities. They should be able to pay assistant coaches more. You know, whatever happens with NIL stuff and collectives and all those things, that could potentially be influenced as well. So they should be able to, and I assume USC will do all of those things. But UCLA, I'm a little more hesitant as to what their plan will be moving forward.
Right. And I do think, like, for USC, even for the players, like, if you're being paid for your image and likeness at this point in time, and you are playing higher profile games and winning them, that means more money for the players too, in terms of their personal deals. So I do think that knowing that you're going to have these high profile games, like, also, like, if you win those games, that boosts your draft prospects. If you're going into the NFL, like, these are all things that players are considering as they choose their location too. So I think that probably, especially at USC, UCLA maybe remains TBD, but yes, yeah, so my USC and UCLA fan friends are, I think, bummed that this probably means the end of the Pac-12. And
at least in as we know it now. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, certainly. And, like, they're a little worried about, you know, the big rivalry of the Big Ten is OSU Michigan, whereas, like, USC UCLA is a really big rivalry out here. And I think they're kind of worried that that tradition will fall by the wayside because of OSU Michigan always being the, like, kind of top dog. And for, while I am out here, like, selfishly, we get the Buckeyes out west, they were like, we're going to have really late kickoffs and that's going to suck. And I was like, oh, you know what? I didn't think about that.
You mean like having, see, I don't know that we, I think that we will see more of games with USC and UCLA, like, be 12:30 local time kickoffs or maybe 4 p.m. kick time. Like, I don't think we're going to see a lot of Big Ten, traditional Big Ten teams in, like, that Pac-12 after dark window. Like, I would be shocked if you see a USC, I don't know, Rutgers game. Well, maybe USC Rutgers, because no one gives a shit about Rutgers. But you're not going to see USC versus Ohio State or Penn State or Michigan or even, like, Wisconsin or Iowa kicking off at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Like, I think that those bigger games will be kept to the traditional noon or 3:30, maybe 7, probably 7 o'clock too, Eastern time windows. You think that there will be later games than that, though?
I think if... Well, so, like, the primetime games are pretty early here, right? Like, the primetime game kicks off at 7:30, 7 or 7:30. So it's usually, like, 4 or 5 here. So that's not terrible. But I think that, like, and I think that's the bigger possibility, is that we get those primetime games. If you have a really good, like, top 10 matchup between USC and one of the Big Ten schools, like, they are going to stick that in the primetime slot, as they should. But I think it was kind of, the concern was, like, those kind of lesser games. And this was coming specifically from UCLA fans who were like,
yeah,
are we going to end up being the night game for these kind of smaller schools and have to stay up to watch like a 10 p.m. kickoff? And I was like, well, first of all, we'll never kick off at 10 p.m. because that's 1 a.m. on the East Coast.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, I mean, you might. I don't, but I agree. I think that that might be like a TBD thing. And we might, it's really probably going to be more like you have to get up at 9 o'clock to watch your game in the morning, which is like how the NFL handles it. And
well, that's what's interesting to me, especially with like USC and potentially UCLA down the road. But like, we know that, as I just talked about the Big Ten football rights, the top half of those rights have already been allocated to Fox. And we know that Fox likes to put its biggest games of the weekend at noon on Saturdays, which would then be, of course, 9 a.m. Pacific time. You mentioned the NFL does this fairly regularly, but there's been a ton of like actual research and noting that when a team plays a game at body clock 9 a.m., they are at a significant disadvantage. I have to wonder if USC and UCLA and potentially Oregon and Washington, who have made it known that they would like to join the Big Ten as well, whether or not they have got some sort of stipulations that say, look, we're not playing in the noon window. We'll play in the 3:30 window, which is 12:30 body clock time. But playing even on the road at noon Eastern time might be something that they're not willing to do, both from a competitive standpoint, but also for their fans as well back on the West Coast.
Because you don't want to lose. I mean, whether or not they have this TV deal, like you don't want to lose the advertising or whatever. If people stop watching the games, cause they don't want to get up at 9 AM. Like it's just, it is, it does get a little dicey in that regard. Also, I think it's something that is interesting is like the amount of travel expenses that cost these teams to bounce back and forth between the, like, you cannot bus to California. You can bus from California to Columbus. Like,
this
is going to be, and not that they're always taking buses within their own conference either, but like,
but even not even football, but like the field hockey teams. And it's been reported that all of the sports will be joining the Big Ten except for USC's beach volleyball team. Everything else, because I don't think there's a beach volleyball. Anybody.
That makes sense.
But like even the non-football men's and women's basketball, the Olympic sports, like that's a huge travel expense that apparently was part of the negotiations. We don't know what that means, but it's been reported that that's been part of the negotiations as well. But like it's not just for USC and UCLA going east, it's for the current existing Big Ten schools going west as well.
Right. And it's like, okay, so like the women's volleyball team, indoor volleyball is expected to just like pay to fly back and forth to play Penn State all the time. Like, come on. Although actually having Penn State in the conference for volleyball is probably a good thing because Penn State tends to be really competitive. So that's a good like trial run of how strong your team is. But that's a whole other thing. I do think I'm curious to see what the negotiations bring as far as the travel. Cause I think that like, it's a financial cost and to your point, it's a physical cost as well.
Yeah.
And we know that with the time difference to Hawaii is much greater than between the Midwest and California, but the basketball tournament that's in Hawaii every year, like teams opt not to go because it takes a physical toll on your body to be bouncing back and forth between time zones like that.
I mentioned the fact that Oregon and Washington have made it clear that they would like to also be considered for Big Ten membership. And apparently the Big Ten has told them, we will keep it under advisement, but we would really like to wait and hear what Notre Dame would like to do. And currently Notre Dame is partially a member of the ACC, not technically a member of the ACC, but plays half of its football games in that conference. But it is not tied to the ACC's grant of rights agreement, which means that nobody in the ACC can leave that conference until 2036, unless the ACC adds members on its own. So while it might be nice for the Big Ten to add like a North Carolina or somebody like that, or for Clemson or Florida State to go to the SEC, that's not going to be feasibly possible for another 14 years unless the ACC adds a team, making that rule no longer applicable, or they let them out of those agreements. But that Notre Dame is not beholden to that. I remember back in the day when Jim Delaney, the former commissioner of the Big Ten, thought that they had an agreement to add Notre Dame, and at the last minute Notre Dame backed out. And even when I worked at the Big Ten in 2004-2005, it was known around the office that under Delaney's watch the Notre Dame would never be asked to join the Big Ten again. If they asked to join, that would be something different. Obviously there's a new commissioner now, Kevin Warren's the commissioner. I think it only makes sense at this point for Notre Dame to join a conference and to join the Big Ten, even though they are not technically in Chicago. They are pretty close to Chicago. So growing up within a stone's throw of South Bend, what would you think about Notre Dame coming in and being at this point the 17th team in the conference, and presuming there would be at least 1 to 3 more teams added after that fact?
I have a couple of thoughts about it.
Of course, yeah.
First is that is a brutal schedule for all of the teams, like not just the Buckeyes from a selfish perspective, but like you're thinking if you think about it, like the Buckeyes could reasonably end up playing USC, Notre Dame, Michigan State, Michigan every year on top of like any of that kind of outlier, like Iowa's who are have these like pockets of being top 10 teams and then kind of fall out a little bit. But like, that's brutal to just have like more than half your schedule consistently be teams that are like top 10, top 15 teams.
But they might say the SEC does that every year with every team, pretty much.
That's true. Yeah, that's a good point. My other issue is that I understand all of the benefits to both the conference and to Notre Dame to have them align with the Big Ten. There is a part of me that's just like, no, screw you. You don't get to be part of our conference at this point. Like, we tried it. You backed out. You have had all the time in the world to align. And I know you've got your like lucrative TV deal, but now you don't get to benefit from that at this point. Also, to the St. Mary's fans in my many people went to St. Mary's. It's the all girls college in South Bend that is they're separate universities, but they have like reciprocity. So the women at St. Mary's get Notre Dame student football tickets and things like that. So the St. Mary's fans in my life, you are innocent, but the Notre Dame fans in my life, I want to see them suffer. They are so annoying. So annoying. I have family members who work at Notre Dame. You are annoying. I don't want you in my conference. Like, let me be
That's
clear.
Totally fair.
And my brother just went to a Notre Dame Tennessee game. And he was like, I've been to OSU Michigan games. I have played Alabama. Like, I have never seen such disrespect from the other team and from the other fans as I did at that Notre Dame game. And I was like, I told you, like, they think that they're better than everyone because they're not in a conference. And I don't want them.
I think that is a very fair thing to not want, but
unless we're just going to humble them and like knock them on their butts year after year. But
see, I think
that's good enough.
I think
that might not happen. So ask me again after the season kicks
September
off.
September 2nd. Yeah.
Yeah. Ask me again after Labor Day.
Yeah. Real quick, let's wrap this up. If let's leave Notre Dame and Oregon and Washington out. If the Big Ten sticks with the current 16 teams, the 14 existing ones in USC, UCLA, how would you prefer they break down the schedule? Would you want those two teams to join the West and move one West team over to the East? Would you want them to get rid of divisions? Do you want them to get rid of the 9 conference game requirement? What are your thoughts on how the schedule should play out with the two West Coast teams being included?
I think initially it makes sense to add them to the West. And my guess is that would be the case anyway, because the West teams are only 2 hours ahead. Like all of the teams in the West are in the central time zone. So I think that also just from a physical standpoint and a scheduling standpoint, like a noon game in Chicago at Northwestern is at 10 a.m., which is a lot more feasible for like West Coast fans to get up and watch. So I think that probably makes the most sense initially. I would like to see them. I don't want to say like do away with divisions, but I would like to see some sort of breakdown where it's like maybe teams of 4 that I don't know. I think
pods.
That there's like little pods and you play your pod every year and then we mix up the other 5 games.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people have talked about. I think our Jordan Williams recently wrote an article advocating for the 3-6-6 model where you have 3 protected rivals and then you play another 6 one year and then another 6 another year, or maybe it's in 2 years you go home and home or whatever, and it rotates those years. I'm in favor of getting rid of the 9 game conference requirement in theory. So what that would do is you would still only have 3 non-conference games that you could schedule against whomever. then in my theory, you would have 8 conference games. But instead of having that ninth conference game, what you would do is actually something that they tried to do a couple years ago during the COVID year, where they were going to have this like weekend of champions, and where obviously the championship game would be the leader in the East versus the leader of the West. And then they were supposed to like break down games accordingly. But that didn't happen because of COVID and all that stuff. I would like to see something like that, to where you would have a weekend that would essentially be a semifinals into the championship weekend. So like, maybe the top, if you're not doing divisions, it's not like the winner of the East versus the winner of the West. So maybe you do the first place team versus the fourth place team, the second place team versus the third place team. They play to go to the championship, and then have other interesting games, avoiding repeats and all of that stuff. But, you know, having an interesting weekend, I think that would be a huge draw for TV. It would get you an opportunity to have teams match up that wouldn't have the opportunity to do it every year. That way, like, if the schedule was rotating and, like, let's say USC and Michigan State, who are not protected rivals, they were not playing every year. They had a great game in 2025, but they weren't on the schedule in 2026. Put them together in that weekend if neither of them were in the top four. I think something like that would be interesting. And in the way that we are making everything for a television viewing experience, I think that would be really interesting. And adding two teams on a completely different coast would be the perfect time to shake things up. And Kevin Warren needs to do some things that are interesting to kind of solidify himself as the commissioner of the conference. Obviously getting those two teams is a huge bonus. But I think that would be a really interesting way to kind of approach it. It'd be great for TV. It'd be great for competition. It would be really interesting. And would kind of alleviate some of the issues of getting rid of divisions when you don't play a round robin and still trying to make sure that you get your best potential playoff teams into that conference championship game.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so we're going to take a real quick break right here, but after the break, we're going to come back and talk about our favorite pieces of pop culture from 2022, so stick around. All right, we are back, and Jamie, we have gotten through the first 6 months of 2022. I don't know how or why we were all asked to do this, but it is been one interesting year so far, and it just keeps continuing to get more interesting and more interesting. And by interesting, I mean like the viral hellscape that it actually is. But one of the saving graces for I know both you and me is entertainment and pop culture. So I wanted to get with you about what your favorite pieces of pop culture were in the first half of this year. We didn't really talk about how we were going to break this down, but I will say you see a lot more movies than I do. So I don't really have a ton of movies on my list, but I assume you have some on yours. Do you want to start with like your favorite movie or movies from 2022 so far?
Absolutely. There are two that stand out. The first one is RRR, which
I wondered if you were going to mention this one.
Matt, you've heard me talk about it. There's no way that this gets bumped as my favorite. Like, it is my favorite movie of 2022 so far. And there's absolutely a 0% chance that anything else will top it before this year is over. I have made my entire family watch it with me over Zoom. I have seen it in theaters several times. We had a very interesting experience at the AMC when we went to see it. There's an intermission in the movie, so they couldn't figure out how to play the second half of the movie. They gave us all a free ticket and said, like, please go home. We will not be showing the second half. And then a week later, they made it right. And I have never been in a crowd that was that rowdy. Like, from the time the trailer started, Chris Pratt got booed during the Jurassic World trailer. And I was like, oh, we are in for a ride today. And it was like constant, just clapping along with the dance numbers. So RRR is a film coming out of India. I actually think it's not a Bollywood film.
It is not. It is from a different, Bollywood is the equivalent of Hollywood, this would be like something made in New York, like another major city. So it's not technically a Bollywood movie.
Correct. And there are three translations of it. Like, you can watch it with English subtitles, but the dubbing of the actual like Indian language, there are three different dialects that it was in, that you can watch it on Netflix. The version on Netflix is dubbed. that didn't take away for me because I don't speak the dialect. And the actors who did the original filming did their own dubbing. So it's cool. Still their voices. It's still the same like emotions. And that all aligned and worked really well for me. There is like a streaming service for Indian films that you can do a free trial for. And then like buy for a month or two, whatever, or continue because the films coming out of India are spectacular. And that does have the original recording in the Telugu language.
Yeah, so, I will say, you mentioned Telugu. RRR is a Tollywood movie, which produces films in Telugu, which is the language that's spoken in the southern parts of India.
Yes. So it is just, I don't want to spoil anything because you watch it and you're like, there's no way that what I just saw, there's no way that anything's going to get crazier. Like you're in the first 5 minutes of the movie and you're like, well, obviously this is all the big action. And it is 3 hours long and every sequence is just more action packed and more exciting than the one before it. People's jaws were on the ground. People were like jumping up and leaning toward the screen and being like, holy shit, what the hell? It's crazy. And it is so spectacular. I believe, Matt, you may be able to fact check me on this, but I believe it is the most expensive film to make in Indian history.
Oh, maybe.
And it is worth every penny. It is a spectacle. And from what it was described, one of my college roommates is Indian. And she was saying that this is like the Titanic of India. Like when Titanic came out in the United States and it was just in theaters for like a whole year, basically. And that's all anyone wanted to talk about. That's what RRR is in India.
Yeah, it had a budget of $72 million, which doesn't sound like a lot for American movies, but it is the most expensive Indian film ever made.
It is a spectacle. Like, run, if it's screening in theaters by you, which it is in like a handful of select cities, run to see it. My brother considered driving to Nashville from Chicago to see it in Nashville because he loved it so much on Netflix and wanted to see it on a big screen. It is absolutely spectacular. 5 stars. And then my other one is Top Gun Maverick.
Oh my God, really?
If you bash this film in my presence, I will get on a plane to Florida and we will have words.
So here's what happened. My brother and his partner, they went and saw it, and both he liked it, she liked it. They loved. My brother texted me, he's like, we've got to go see Top Gun Maverick. Like, this was on a Friday. So we went and saw it on Monday, and I was like, all right, fine. I kind of despise everything that Tom Cruise stands for, but all right, I'll go see it. And it was fine. Like, it was good. It wasn't amazing to me. The one movie I was going to mention, my brother and I and his daughter, my niece, we went and saw the week before, and I liked that a lot more, which we'll get to. But like, it was fine. Like, it worked. I teared up at certain parts, which is not that big of a deal for me because I do that at everything. But like, I was expecting more based off of all of the adoration that it was getting.
I mean, I just vehemently disagree. I would go. We have like a group of friends who go to the movies on Tuesday nights, and you know, it's a big group, so different people can come on different weeks. It's not the whole group every time, but every time people are not able to go and it's just like me and two or three other people, we're like, should we see Top Gun again? And we just continue to go back.
What is it about it that you love so much?
Big planes go fast. Jennifer Connelly in her MILF era.
I mean, fair enough.
Listen, Tom Cruise, I don't trust him and I don't like him. And I agree with nothing that he stands for. But I will say, watching Nicole Kidman do the AMC placement and then have like kick in and be like, welcome to Top Gun Maverick. I was like, what year is it? I love this.
Heartache feels good when you're here.
Yeah, heartbreak feels good in a place like this. And then a Tom Cruise kicks in and you're like, oh man, this is so perfect. My little like 1997 self is ecstatic. It's the planes, it's the callbacks to the original film. And I think the thing that I don't love about a lot of the like Marvel and action films nowadays is like, there are so many sequels that have already been announced that you kind of know going in that they're not going to, like, you're watching it. You're like, well, I know they can't kill you because you have three more movies coming out.
That's
that
fair.
Have already been announced. But I was watching Top Gun and I was like, any of you could die at any point. I have no clue how this is going to end.
What is your thoughts on the theory that this movie was really just a death dream for Maverick, that in that opening scene when he was going, spoiler alert, Mach 10 or whatever, he actually died, and that everything that happened afterwards was his brain kind of trying to make peace with everybody in his past, especially because there's like nothing really specific. Like, they never say who the enemy is. They never say where they're going. It's just very vague and nonsensical. And that might have to do with the fact that it's actually just Maverick's brain trying to fix everything that he did wrong in his life through this crazy mission that actually doesn't make any logical sense.
I think that that is silly. Like, it's Top Gun. Guys, it's not that deep. It's just not. They didn't put that much thought into it. It's just planes
clearly,
go fast.
Yeah.
Like, it's just planes go fast. That's it. They're not thinking about, like, is the enemy in Russia? Like, we don't know. We don't need
Canada,
to know.
Right? It's Canada. Canada's our enemy, right?
It must be, certainly.
Canada or Russia. I mean, that's really all it could be, I think.
Really, yeah. I was thinking Russia, but... really could be.
It's more fun if it's Canada.
It's way more fun if it's Canada. Or, like, plot twist, it's just like one of our states.
It's Colorado.
It's Alaska.
Sarah Palin has turned Alaska into its own country and they are our enemy. I'm fine with that. That's fine.
Yeah.
So I have not seen a ton of movies. I watched a bunch of movies at the beginning of the year to prep for the Oscars, but a lot of those are like 2021 movies. So I'm not going to count those. But in terms of like the legit 2022 movies that I've seen, I've really only gone out to movie theaters and seen like the big blockbustery type things. Like, I've seen, you know, Doctor Strange. I saw Everything Everywhere All at Once. I saw, obviously, Top Gun Maverick. I'm scrolling through my list, see if there's anything else that I've seen. Not really. There really hasn't been a ton of other movies. But the one that I am going to mention that I will say is my favorite movie that I've seen in a movie theater this year, you already mentioned it. It's Jurassic World Dominion. So,
Matt, I am going to hang up this call.
Well, let me just tell you this. My brother and my niece did not like this movie at all, but I liked it because it didn't take me long to realize that this movie's a comedy. Like, if once you realize that this is a movie where they're in on the jokes, like, I laughed a lot. Like, I thought that some of the ridiculousness was done on purpose. I thought a lot of the little, like, sly jokes were really funny. Like, there's a moment, and this isn't a spoiler, I don't think, but there's a moment towards the end of the film when a giant dinosaur walks in front of a big ornamental piece that has a big circle, and it turns into the Jurassic Park logo. Like, I laughed out loud. Like, is it a good movie? Probably not. Did I enjoy the hell out of it? Absolutely. I thought it was so bad. Like, it's nonsensical. You talking about, like, the nostalgia of Top Gun Maverick, seeing the original stars, Laura Dern, Jeff Goldblum, Sam Neill, B.D. Wong, like, seeing them back, like, there's tons of nostalgia there. I would have probably preferred if we could have gotten rid of all of the Chris Pratt, Bryce Dallas Howard stuff, because for somebody, or for people who are supposed to have been a couple now for like three movies, they have like negative on the chemistry scale, which is quite shocking to me. But if you would have given me Laura Dern, Jeff Goldblum, Sam Neill, B.D. Wong, DeWanda Wise, who's new to the cast in this, even throw in a little bit of Isabella Sermon, who plays the young girl that is like the Chris Pratt, Bryce Dallas Howard's adopted daughter. Like, she was good, and I liked Mamadou Athi, who is the head of communications at BIOS, and like basically everybody other than Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard, I actually really enjoyed and thought did a good job. And once I realized that this was a movie that was poking fun at itself throughout, I liked it. I liked it more than I liked Top Gun. I liked it more than I liked Doctor Strange, and I'm a huge Marvel person, but this was an enjoyable time at the theater for me.
I mean, I didn't have a bad time at the theater, but it was like a one star on Letterboxd.
The fact that you're a Letterboxd person tells me everything I need to know about how you go into movies. So that's that. All right, let's turn to TV. I believe I've talked about some of these shows on previous episodes, so I'm not going to go into like Severance or Peacemaker, two shows that I thought were near perfect seasons of television for me, doing very different things. I loved both of those. But a couple shows that I want to mention that I think might have flown under the radar. One just came out a couple weeks ago in mid to late June called The Lake. It is a it's a comedy out of Canada. It's a series that has just, or the season that just has 8 episodes. I really hope that it has a second season. It stars, were you an Orphan Black person, Jamie?
I have watched pockets of it and have loved everything that I've seen, but I have never like watched it from start to finish.
I'll say Orphan Black, I think the first season is possibly the perfect season of television. Season 2 and 3 were also good, diminishing returns in 4 and 5. But one of the stars of Orphan Black is Jordan Gavaris, who plays in that show the main character's multiple main characters' adopted brother, Felix. He is the lead of this show, The Lake. The co-lead in the show is played by Julia Stiles, and they play step-siblings who have had a lifelong rivalry, and they are effectively feuding over their family's lake house. And throwing into the mix the fact that Jordan's character, Justin, is a gay man who is reconnecting with the adopted daughter that he gave up when he was in high school. He is white. She is part black. The mother is black. And so he's bringing her to the lake, and they're feuding with the stepsister and trying to figure all that out. It was sweet. It was really funny, really smart. It's a very queer show too. Lots of like good positive representation in that department. Really lovely show, a quick watch, 8 episodes. It was probably my favorite thing on TV this year. So I will recommend that. That's on Prime Video, on Amazon Prime Video. Then over on HBO Max, actually it started on HBO, but it's a very similar thing, 7 episode comedy-ish type thing. It's called Somebody Somewhere, starring New York cabaret icon Bridget Everett. She plays a woman who is kind of going through life in her hometown of Manhattan, Kansas, which is where Bridget Everett actually is from. And she just kind of stumbles backwards into finding her own community and finding her own sense of self. It's a really lovely show. Also stars Jeff Hiller and renowned drag king Murray Hill. Again, another very queer positive show. It has been renewed for a second season, I believe. So I'm very much looking forward to that. And then one that just dropped on FX on Hulu this past week. I've already finished it. Another 8 episode thing that is mildly a comedy. It's a show called The Bear, starring Jeremy Allen White, who people might know from Shameless. Also stars Iban Moss Backrack and Ayo Edebiri, as well as Abby Elliott shows up, Oliver Platt shows up, John Barenthal, Joel McHale, Molly Ringwald all make appearances, some very small. But it's about like one of the best chefs in the world who is forced to return to his Chicago home to run his family's Italian beef shop after there's tragedy in the family. And having worked in restaurants a lot in my life, although I was a server and not, you know, in the kitchen, lots of PTSD for food service. But it was really a remarkably made television series. And the penultimate episode, episode 7 of 8, might be one of the best episodes of television ever made from both an acting and technical standpoint. So that's out there on Hulu now. So The Lake on Prime Video, Somebody Somewhere on HBO Max, and The Bear on Hulu. 3 of my favorite things that I think might have gone under the radar for a lot of folks.
Amazing.
Have you watched any of those? Have you heard of any of those?
I have heard of The Lake because Julia Stiles. She is someone who just like should have had, she should be working consistently and like be, she should have had a big, not that she hasn't had a big career, but like, I feel like after the kind of like 90s, early 2000s rom-coms, she kind of just like fell under the radar somewhere.
Yeah. And I don't know why.
She's a spectacular actress. Like she should be in everything. So I have heard of The Lake. I've not seen any of those three though.
They're great. And what's nice about them is I like a good short series with good short episodes, you know, like all of those shows, like the episodes are max 35 minutes. So I do love that. What about you? Did you have you watched any TV that you really enjoyed?
Yeah. So I have two that are, I've spoken a lot about like Hacks, Only Murders in the Building, which
both
just dropped
awesome.
Second season, right now. And the Hack season 2 came out a few weeks ago and
so good,
or I guess a few months ago, but it was dropped like episode by episode, 2 at a time. So that just wrapped season 2 and, both are excellent. The, Only Murders is on Hulu and Hacks is on HBO Max. But the, I mean, my favorite show so far is definitely Abbott Elementary. I think that it accomplishes the comedy goals that haven't really, in a way that like hasn't really been done since kind of like The Office and Parks and Rec. But it's better than those in my opinion. And part of what I think is so spectacular about it is that most shows of that nature, including The Office and Parks and Rec, don't really hit their sweet spot or figure out what they are until like season 2. And Abbott Elementary just knew from the first episode, this is what we are. This is what we're trying to accomplish. There's so much heart, even in the characters that are like allegedly unlikable, like very quickly you understand the nuance and the layers to those people in a way that makes you love and empathize with them. And I just think that that is so special. And it's like laugh out loud funny. And my other one is a pivot from that. It's I think it's an FX show on Hulu, but it's definitely streamable on Hulu. Under the Banner of Heaven. If you are it's a true crime show, but it's not even really like the crime is kind of secondary to the rest of the show. It stars Andrew Garfield as a police detective in Utah. He is Mormon. His co-detective is Native American. And they are investigating the murder of a Mormon woman and her baby. And they initially believe that the husband is the one who murdered them. And then you find out that it was actually his family. And it is the first show in a long time that is like a crime show that I usually, when I watch like an 8-episode crime thing, I'm like, this should have been a 2-hour documentary or a 2-hour movie. Like I don't need 8 hours worth of this. This was the first time where I was like, oh, I actually did. I maybe didn't need 7 episodes. I think it could have been 6, but I was so glad it was a series because what I think it did such a spectacular job of is establishing like, this is the Mormon belief system. This is where the fundamentalist Mormons have broken off, and it really clearly explains the break in those beliefs in a way that I think it's very easy to be like, ah, Mormons like a cult, ha ha ha, and like laugh at them. And it didn't feel that way. Like it felt like a very genuine look at what people believe, and then also established like where things go awry with the fundamentalists. It didn't feel mocking. It felt very genuine. And it also focused less on the crime and more on the Andrew Garfield character's kind of crisis of faith as he's uncovering things about the Mormon church and the fundamentalist Mormons and where that break in the belief systems happened. He starts to question his own faith. And I think that the focus on that and less on the crime is so spectacular and so fascinating as a character study, that I found it to just be like absolutely riveting.
Awesome. I love that. I try to stay away from true crime. I used to work in true crime stuff, so I don't watch a ton of that, but I've only heard great things about that one. Some other things I'll shout out. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I think true crime, there are times where it can be really like exploitative, and this didn't feel that way. Like the crime really is just the catalyst for you to study Andrew Garfield's character and understand. And like, you don't ever like see the gore of the crime. It's just kind of implied, like he shows up to investigate and you know that he found a mother and her baby killed, but like you don't see anything. They don't reenact it. It felt very much like you need to know that this happened in order to understand the rest of the story, but this is not what we're here to focus on. And then you saw like the mother in life, like you would see these kind of flashbacks to who she was that made her in-laws so upset with her to the point that they would murder her. But like, you don't, the crime itself is not the focal point of that.
Yeah. Cool. Well, I'll throw out just a couple of things that I really liked. I loved Outer Range on Prime Video. I love The Old Man that's currently playing on FX on Hulu is really good as well, as is Dark Winds on AMC and AMC Plus. After Party, which I've talked about before. See if there's anything else that is really, really good that needs to be shouted. I started watching The Great Pottery Throwdown on HBO Max, too. I'm two seasons in. I love that. Oh, as somebody who loves...
So good.
As somebody who loves the Great British Bake Off, like this is a spinoff of that. So I love that. So I love the pottery one. After I finish all of the pottery stuff, I'm going to go over to Netflix and watch the glass blowing show.
So have you watched the chocolate show on Netflix?
Which one?
I don't know what it's called.
I've watched a lot of different baking and chocolate shows on Netflix.
Let me see. I'm going to Google it really fast. Okay, School of Chocolate.
No, I don't think I have.
Oh my gosh, it's insane.
Okay, I'll put that on the list.
They're building like giant, like life-size dragons out of chocolate. Like yeah, it's just see, crazy.
Those are the things I don't get down with the like those like making something like that looks fantastical. Like that's fine. Like I can have a challenge of that here every once in a while, but I prefer just like the doing the thing. But yeah, we'll see. But like you said, loved Hacks. Russian Doll season 2 was a bit trippy, but I enjoyed that. Nonetheless, the Ipcris file on AMC Plus was also very good. Real quick, I want to shout out the two theater pieces that I've seen this year that I love the most so far. And these are, again, things that I'm seeing for the first time in 2022. If I've seen, like, I'm not including, like, Company, which I saw in 2021, or anything, or Six, which I saw in 2021 and in 2022. So just talking about the things that I've seen for the first time here is a play by Brenna Turner called At the Wedding, which was at Lincoln Center Theater, LCT3, and it starred Mary Wiseman, who I actually interviewed. She is one of the stars of one of the Star Trek TV shows. I don't know which one, but she was great at that, where she is going to the wedding of her ex-girlfriend who is marrying a man, and she's kind of self-destructing, but a really lovely show. And then one that, Jamie, that I'm sure that if you still lived in New York City, you would have been at least 6 or 7 times, because it seems like right up your alley. And this is Which Way to the Stage from MCC Theater, written by Anna Nuguiero and directed by Mike Donahue. Basically centers around two best theater-loving best friends who stage door a musical called If Then that stars Idina Menzel. And it's a lot more than that. It's a lot more about relationships and identity and being true to yourself and figuring out who you are. But those are my two favorite shows, theater pieces that I've seen this year. And they're both short comedies, so I guess that's kind of like my trend, and very queer friendly, I guess, as well. So a lot of my things this year have been short, funny, queer or queer adjacent, and entertaining.
Yeah. I have actually not seen a whole lot of theater, but I did just buy a Pasadena Playhouse season.
Oh, nice. They do such good stuff there.
They do such good stuff. And the next season is A Little Night Music, Sunday in the Park.
That's right. And Bernadette's going to be there.
And a Bernadette Peters concert, and Sanctuary City. And there's another one that is escaping me right now. So I'm very excited for that. I did just see Tambo and Bones
That's rough.
Kirk Douglas. That is some heavy.
Yeah, I saw it in New York. I saw it at Playwrights Horizons I don't know if you know Grace, but you know of Grace Aki. We went and saw it, and we were not entertained.
And then I also saw Lempicka down at La Jolla Playhouse.
So jealous.
Which, like, I don't really want to comment on because, yeah. Matt, you and I have talked offline. It is a show that is still in its development process. And there's no creative team that I trust more to figure it out. So that I did see the Williamstown version and thought it was spectacular and really just needed like a slight polishing. And somehow in right now they're in the process of polishing where, like, you know how things sometimes get a little messier before they get really clean. Like when you start to tackle cleaning a messy room and you're like, oh, the mess is going to get worse before it's better. They're in the it's worse phase. But I also could identify as I was watching it exactly what they were trying to do. Like I understood why they made the changes that they made. And I trust this creative team to fit those puzzle pieces together before it hits Broadway. It is being tracked for Broadway. And Eden Espinosa has quite seriously never sounded better. And she has always been spectacularly talented. She has never sounded better. And I thought that Amber Iman was, she is playing the role of Rafaela, and I had never seen her perform live. Holy cow. Like I would listen to her sing all day long. Like she was spectacular in that role. So the bones of the show are really good. And I trust that they're going to figure out how to configure those pieces in a way that just becomes the next like Hadestown or Great Comet. Directed by Rachel Chavkin, who is directing Limpika. So the bones are good. It's interesting. Like the music is really spectacular, but it doesn't necessarily like, it's not a cohesive score. And so I think they need to play with some of that. But I think they also, it's pretty clear which songs will stay. And, you can listen to a few of the tracks on Spotify, Apple Music, wherever you get your music. Woman is like probably the best.
It's the best new show tune I've heard in a long time. Yeah.
Like years. It is listening to Eden sing that live. I was just like, oh, because I always really liked and respected her work, but I wouldn't say I was like an Eden stan. And then I like saw it live with my own two eyeballs. And I was like, well, now I have to like kiss the ground that you walk on because that was superhuman.
Let me ask you a question. Is she the Julia Stiles of musical theater? Like somebody who there's no real good reason why she has not done more, but she has not been on Broadway since, I guess, the closing cast of Rent. But before that, it was really just Wicked and Brooklyn, which is where I fell in love with her, was in the cast album of Brooklyn. She did the national tour of Falsettos and has done things out of town, but like really has not gotten the accolades and the opportunities that I think her talent deserves.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree. I think especially seeing this, like what she is doing is just on another level. And it's interesting. The Amber Iman role was played by Carmen Cusack at Williamstown. And they are very different actresses. So like, I was really curious to see how that played out. The other person that I would maybe put in that category is Shoshana Bean, who's had a similar, like, she did Wicked. She was in Hairspray prior to doing Wicked. And then she was a waitress replacement. But like up until right now, she is in Mr. Saturday Night and received a Tony nomination. Until that point, like she's another one that just kind of would go like forever without any real role or career. And I think her and Eden both similarly just should have consistently been like working. They should just be in everything.
I agree. Yeah, I've interviewed Eden before. I interviewed Matt Gould, who's the composer of Limpika, just while they were in rehearsals. And he said that things were still changing. They had done a lot of changes during the pandemic and will continue to do changes until it comes to Broadway. I know that they are currently trying to find a house for it because I am close with people connected with that production. So I know that they are actively looking to find the right place to bring it to Broadway, hopefully in this coming 2022-2023 season, probably in the spring of 2023. So we will see what happens there.
Yeah, I'm really, really rooting for it. It's just, you know, I believe that shows, I mean, look at like A Strange Loop. It took 20 years for that show to get to be what it is. Like it shows that are new need to have room to grow and evolve through the creative process. And so I think if you're seeing a show out of town in its pre-Broadway run, please go into it with that mindset of like, you are the audience, that you're the test audience. Like, you're going to help this take its final shape. And be like kind, because most shows are not salvageable the way that Lempicka is salvageable. And the bones are so good. I'm really rooting for it.
I saw a show earlier this spring that you would think, based off of the talent of the creative team and on stage, that it would be something looking to come to New York, and it very well might. I saw it out of town, and it was not a good show. Like, literally, some of my favorite musical theater writers wrote it. Some of my favorite musical theater performers starred in it, and it was not good. I talked about it over on a Broadway Radio episode of This Week in Theater a couple months ago, but no bueno. So I'm hoping that if they do decide to move forward with that, they do a substantial rewrite. But anyway, yeah. Let's get out on that. That is all that we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Land Grant Holy Land Stick to Sports Podcast. If you are finding this episode on our website, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your daily dose of podcasting goodness. And if you like our particular brand of disparity and eclecticness, make sure wherever you're getting your podcast that you leave us a rating and review. Also, you can follow Land Grant Holy Land on Twitter at LandGrant33. You can find me on Twitter at BWWMatt. Jamie, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter at Jamie Arch.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. For the 6.5 of you that have actually stayed to listen this far, we really appreciate it. We will talk to you soon. And as always, go Bucks.